forth about hills, and Steve said, "Oh yeah, that area's real hilly." I said, "Well, it's all relative. When you carry a quarter ton with you, which Steve will be describing, versus carrying 10 or 20 pounds on your bike, it makes a big difference when you approach hills." Anyway, with that, I'll leave it to Steve, and hope we have a good lecture. Thank you.
Actually, if we measure a progress in terms of pound miles per hour instead of miles per hour, I'm a lot faster than he is. I guess we could start with this tape. I guess probably not very many of you have seen this actually in motion. There was a little wave of local publicity a couple days ago. I showed up here for the San Diego Electronics Show, and there was this PR guy, and some of these PR people are just amazing. He waved this magic wand and got the whole press contingent from all the San Diego stations to show up simultaneously at the Star of India. So we have the clips here, which run by real quick. The real bike is here, so there's hardly any reason to use that as a method of seeing it, but it does show what it looks like in motion and some of that stuff, and also some good Qualcomm coverage on a couple of them. So, is it ready?
Bicycle, but not anybody. It's called the HEMA. That stands for Big Electronic Human-Energized Machine Only Too Heavy, Behemoth. Just your everyday $1 million computerized high-tech bicycle.
Are you okay?
Star of India, a familiar sight for San Diegans, but here comes something not so familiar. Steve Roberts on the bike he conceived and built. A quick glance tells you this is a far cry from your 10-speed. For one thing, it has 105 speeds.
I go with bicycles at a cellular phone.
That's the least of it. The bike has a satellite station from Qualcomm here in San Diego. It finds a satellite 23,000 miles in space and sends and receives Steve's electronic mail. Solar panels power everything, except the pedals, of course. There's a CD player. And there's a voice synthesizer so his bike can talk to him. The voice wasn't working today. High-tech sore throat. With his onboard computers. He writes books and a newsletter, which he can do completely from his bike.
It really does work. Now I don't have to tell you anything. Any questions?
Background,
that's what I was saying. Okay, what was happening basically, in 1983 I had managed to convert all my hobbies into a business, which is a surefire way of trashing a hobby. And I was doing computer design and consulting and writing and anything else I could manage to get paid for that were spin-offs of the same basic lifelong passion with techno-gizmology. And the problem was that I was doing it on a consulting basis and working very hard trying to pay the bills, and the bills were mounting up because I had this 3-bedroom ranch in suburbia. And suddenly I realized, this was in Ohio, suddenly I realized that I was working at something I didn't enjoy, trying to pay for something I didn't want. And that's really stupid. So one afternoon when I was feeling particularly creative, I was just made a list of the things that I really love, you know, made a list of passions, basically. Things like travel and adventure and computers, networking, hacking, except I didn't know that term then in this same context, bicycles, romance, publishing. And so the solution was obvious. Just take computers and ham radios, stick them on a high-tech bicycle, and wander around while writing about it for a living. So I set about trashing my lifestyle, which took about 6 months, yard sales and things like that. Did about $11,000 in just a liquidation of possessions. Everything had a price. And little holes started appearing all over the house as the bike started to build in one of the spare rooms. And about 6 months later, I pedaled away and just left everything that was left over behind me in the hands of my realtor. A few months later, the house sold and got me up to about zero, and that's the freest I've ever been financially. up until that point. So what happened then is I took off from Ohio and rode a little loop around the Midwest to test the original concept, which was much simpler. This was 1983, so the bike was fairly robust for its day, and everybody was telling me it was way too heavy at 135 pounds. It's now 580, fully loaded. In fact, there was one guy who swore that he'd wait for me at the bottom of the first big hill out in Muskingum County and follow me up as I started jettisoning things I obviously didn't really need after all. I rode east to D.C. and all the way down the coast to Key West, Florida, and then meandered around Florida for a while and headed cross-country and up through Colorado, down to Southern California, and up the coast, all of which was about 10,000 miles and led to long, after many publishing nightmares and other problems, led to this book. Led to this Computing Across America book, which has been out for a little while. It's about that first trip. And yes, I know you're all wondering, I do have inventory here. the only problem with that is, well, there were a couple problems. First of all, there was the fact that I was living on a bicycle and having this adventure, it was no automatic cure for lousy work habits. So I still wasn't getting much work done. My standard work mode as a freelancer has always been PFD, which is procrastination followed by despair. Email and FedEx let you push the limits a little bit closer, but still I didn't really solve the problem. So that was a problem. The other thing is that every 10,000 miles is about 1,000 hours of pedaling time. And so for half of a business year, basically, I was sitting on the bike, awake, alert, alive, but not productive. And then there was tremendous overhead on top of that. So my actual output, being able to actually produce stories, was really constrained by the fact that I was living on a bicycle. And that started seeming wrong to me. So without going through too many details, basically what I wanted to do was just add a handlebar keyboard. I play flute. You know, flutes, you get 3 octaves out of 9 fingers, so why not use it for text? So the Winnebiko 2 was born. And that incorporated the keyboard and the handlebars with 4 buttons on each side, and I just typed an ASCII. And I rotated a little bit, so the low 5 bits of the ASCII character were these fingers, and these were the zone bits. And it was amazingly efficient once I got used to it. It wasn't the world's best coding scheme for such things, but it worked. And it's certainly easy to learn, because if you forget Q, you just start up from P, you know. So, I did a console system somewhat like this, except it was very, very rigid architecturally. And I had packet radio and a few other things, but what I quickly discovered is that every time I wanted to add something, like going back and adding a cellular phone or some other little computer toy, what I ended up doing was editing with a soldering iron rather than editing with a screen editor. And as I started learning more about the way things can really be done to build systems, I started getting more and more frustrated by that, to the point of turning down an invitation to go show it around Japan under NEC's sponsorship, because it started to seem like a real antique to me. So cutting to the chase, which is, this is the machine you really want to see here. So about 3 years ago, I decided to do it right. And that's when I started the Behemoth project. As the video said, Behemoth stands for Big Electronic Human Energized Machine, Only Too Heavy. That is a bit of a problem. One of the unstated design goals of this thing is to maximize the function to weight ratio. And my approach to that has been to increase functionality exponentially and increase weight only linearly. And so they go like this, and the only doubt, it's fine, functional weight ratio still increases, but I also still have to pedal it. So as Butch pointed out, that leads to some interesting problems. I go very slowly, and that's partially aided by the mechanical system here. I have about 105, well not about, exactly 105 gears. It doesn't have the same ring to it. It's not like hopping on your 10 speed, hopping on your 105 speed. But anyway, there are 3 derailleurs. It's a 5x3x7 matrix. And I can control that, of course, nicely while riding. The only problem with that is that it gets down to some very low gears, and on a steep hill at a granny gear of 7.9 inches, I lose lateral stability. So the landing gear assembly here, which are now retracting in a pneumatic control if you can't see them, they're up when I'm riding. And some people like to call them training wheels, but I don't encourage it. Well, from a system standpoint, there's some fundamental design goals here I should talk about before getting into specifics, because it's easy to get lost in those without wondering what the point is. Philosophically, what I'm trying to do is eliminate any distinction between movement and stasis. In other words, I want to be able to be just as productive on the bike while pedaling or sitting in a campground or in somebody's house or wherever I happen to be, theoretically anywhere in the world. I want to be able to be just as productive there as I am sitting at my workstation and surrounded by computers and phones and power lines in Silicon Valley. So that's kind of an ambitious design goal, but as you know, being in the wireless business, there are some interesting tools available that make that a little bit easier these days. So that's a major fundamental objective here. Another thing is that I want this system to be entirely bus structured, so it's as flexible as possible. And what that all boils down to is that every device, whether it's an Omnitrax terminal or a cellular phone or a ham radio or a speaker on my headset or anything except for basic safety equipment, has to be just an addressable device on a big bus. And what that means is that every power switch is just an addressable bit under control of a 68HC11 running forth. Every serial device is an address in a cross-point network with nodes at all three sites here, the trailer, the rump, and the console. Rump is rear unit of many purposes. The trailer is often called the Wazoo, by the way, which is the wheeled auxiliary storage unit. And all audio devices, likewise, are networked together. And that one's kind of interesting. There are 8 audio long lines that run the length of the bike, and they're completely uncommitted. No dedicated line from the cellular phone back here to the headset or anything like that. And at each site, there's a board that is an audio cross-point switch matrix. This is one that I had to design and get built. One of the few, most parts I use. For the most part, I use existing products. But anyway, each one of those boards allows 16 inputs and 16 outputs to be connected to any of those bus lines. And there's a fourth task in these HC11s associated with each one that just grabs the first available bus line and makes the appropriate connections. So if I want to connect, like on the video, they were talking about the bike calling the police when latitude and longitude change when I'm not logged in. It turns out the code to actually implement that is really trivial. Just pipe some, turn on the link between the speech synthesizer and the cellular phone, 2 bits. Now the connection's made. Grab data off the serial bus from the GPS receiver and pass it to the speech synthesizer, and you know, with some preface text. So given all that, and the need for serviceability and freedom from fixed power resources and everything, here's what I ended up with. So let's see. Let me run through major systems real quick, and then we'll go into question and answer mode, which is a little more interactive. The main power system is solar, of course. There's 72 watts of solar panels here. This is almost 5 amps in full sun under the 12-volt batteries. That's one of 4 possible charge sources. It can also recharge from a line-operated switcher, a little resonant power supply that produces about 8 amps when I have AC available. It can charge from somebody's cigarette lighter if there's only 12 volts available. That's just a little DC to DC converter. And eventually, not done yet, the new front wheel will have a variable reluctance motor generator as its hub and will attempt to satisfy a braking request by decoding the dead band as I start to squeeze the right-hand brake lever and using it as an input to a servo loop to try to take the energy that I'm trying to dissipate and do something with it other than heat up brake pads. In other words, proportionally throw it into the power bus, and if I keep squeezing harder, then just let the hydraulics close. So all of that stuff produces this big power bus. There's 2 sealed lead acids back here from Sun and Shine and 1 in here. And they're all they're treated as one battery, basically, when the thing's connected. And all loads, as I mentioned, they're all just addressable devices. So this 12-volt bus runs every place, and anywhere I want to turn something on, there's a little FET, and it gets a line from a 5-volt to 15-volt level shifter off of one of the little fourth boards. And in many cases, what's associated with that FET or what it's turning on is a little dedicated DC to DC converter that provides 5 volts for whatever that local system is. So if I want to turn on a little DOS machine down here, for example, I just send it a bit and it wakes up and grabs power and regulates it locally, so it's nice and efficient. There's some active power management that goes on there. There's a task in one of the micros that looks at current drain and so on. So I can bring it all up. I should mention the architecture, so the rest of this will make sense. These 3 HC11s, these fourth controllers, are tied together through serial lines, and the bus is called the bicycle control processor. It's up in here. And its console port is connected to the Macintosh, and the Mac is the high-level graphic user interface. It's this top screen here. And it runs HyperCard. And so what I actually see is this HyperCard display. And each card represents some applications layer, like continue the discussion of power. If I want to see the status of the battery, it'll show a little box that represents the battery, and it's some percentage full with something shaded, which represents its percentage of charge, and there's a vertical line that'll move back and forth, indicating whether it's charging or discharging. And that all translates, for implementing any kind of active control or going out and collecting data from that, HyperCard then generates these fourth text command lines, which then get sent down to lower level systems. So as the human operator, I don't have to deal with this, I don't have to feel the bits between my toes when I want to talk to the thing. Moving on to computers, there are the Mac is sort of the primary applications environment. In addition to HyperTalk, is Microsoft Word and things like that. That's my primary operating environment. But the human interface part of it is kind of fun. I now have a newer handlebar keyboard that's much more interesting. So I'm sitting here like this. There are now 8 buttons on each side. It's a much nicer position. My hands are just at my side here. And each one of these, the keyboard on the right-hand side is connected to 3 separate little micros that are called BAT controllers. There's a commercial cord keyboard now from InfoGrip that was attractive for this because somebody had already dealt with the problems of making it work nicely with DOS and interfacing all these things that I didn't have to think about. So there are 3 controllers on the keyboard, one for the Mac, one for the Spark Station, which I'll mention in a moment, and one for the DOS machine that runs the heads-up display in the helmet. And as I'm typing, there's one of the tests in the bicycle control processor decides which target environment the handlebar keyboard gets connected to. So I can switch between these 3 different environments real quickly and easily and use the Mac or the Spark or whatever to type at a reasonable speed. Since I can only do about 35 words a minute in cording, I find that frustratingly slow because on a standard keyboard, I'm about 75 or 80 or something like that. So the solution is this program called PRD Plus, lets me type in macros, but it only runs on DOS. So we pipe the keystrokes through the DOS machine. I keep pointing at the helmet when I say this because its display is here. this runs this TSR that lets me type in macros and then squirts it back out the serial port toward the Mac, where a friend of mine wrote this piece of code that makes it think it's a keyboard. So the user interface that I see when I'm going through all of this stuff is it starts to feel like a windowing system after a while. I've been sitting around the Sun for about a year, and I've gotten used to using Unix, and in fact, this has become a Unix cycle. Now that there's a Spark on board. Here's the full picture here. I don't know why people look at me strangely when I got pulled over once. Actually, it was before this version, but it still looked kind of strange. I got pulled over in South Hill, Virginia by this cop with lights and siren and everything and the gesture to pull over. And, hey, that's not this. So I did, and he came over with his hand on his service revolver and kind of looked me over and says, I just want to see what the hell y'all got here. What's that? Right, yeah, and then he called his chief on the radio so he could come see it. Wasted an hour. The environment that I see when I'm actually riding along in this thing reminds me a lot of a windowing system, because background, root, so to speak, speaking of windowing terms, is reality. It's changing and the world's going by. And then I've got a window here, which is this heads-up display. It's a 720 by 280 screen that's owned by the little DOS machine. So that's one environment that I use for database and a terminal into the fourth machine if I want to do some hacking, or there's some online stuff where I can control the ham radio with it because I haven't written the stuff for HyperCard yet. So my right eye can glance down and see this. My left eye can glance down and see the Macintosh, or through this mechanical display paging scheme here. I can lift this up. And right now there's a VGA display there for DOS, but it's going away. Sharp just said yes to their new thin film active matrix color screen. So it's going in there with the Spark Station behind it and half a gigabyte of disk. And then there's a smaller screen down there, so there's all these little teensy windows, sort of icon size, that show me things like the time and my speed and so on. And then there's a little circular window up here, which is reality behind me. And the only problem with that whole approach is that I can't swap them around, because sometimes the reality of the route is really boring, like a bunch of cornfields, and I'd like to be able to stick it into a small window and take the CAD system.
Yeah.
Well, actually, if I go to the holodeck, then I won't need to pedal anymore. Then I can just emulate the entire thing.
How do you do mouse stuff?
Ah, thank you. Yes, cursor positioning is done ultrasonically. There are three sensors in the helmet here, and there's a 40 kilohertz signal transmitted from the console. And as I move my head around, the phase and Doppler changes are converted into quadrature by a little board up front, which then gets passed to a hacked ADB mouse, and so the Mac just thinks it's mouse movement. And
how do you activate?
It's ultrasonic. It sees head movement, and there are two thumb buttons involved in this. One, with my left thumb, I say track me. Otherwise, I'd be putting cursors on everybody I look at. Wow, she's cute. Click, click, click. And then the right-hand thumb button is for clicking. Now, I'm just in the process of changing this. This works pretty well on the bench and kind of okay on the bike, but what's happened with this one is just a packaging problem. When I put it in the helmet and ran it through this capacitor and so on, what we ended up with is lots of capacitance between these and the board, and so it's kind of flaky in reality. And it's just now coming out. Logitech has just come out with in alpha a new head mouse. It's an ultrasonic 6D mouse, and the thing's got three transmitters and three receivers on a little triangle about this big. And it's beautiful. It resolves not only all the rotation, but also these movements. And I don't really need that, but in head tracker mode, it's good for a 7-foot cube. It's real robust, and it's done, and it plugs in ADB, and it's cool. So I'm in the process of changing that. There are a couple other things when I'm talking about the helmet. It's nice. I can feel lightheaded, of course, just by throwing a switch. And there's high and low beam or spot and flood there. There's the audio system in the helmet is two speakers and a microphone, sort of police motorcycle grade stuff, which takes moisture real well. And finally, and one of the best parts, one of the problems with pedaling a large machine like this, especially on hot days, is that you really cook. And one of my complaints about being a biological organism is that I'm not 100% efficient, which is really a drag because I generate all this waste heat when I'm working. And so the body starts to overheat and well, I just figured out I saw this book. Body freedom. Body starts to overheat, and normally it likes to cool itself through all these available paths, like perspiration and also heat flow out the top of the head. Well, I've blocked that with a styrofoam insulator here, for safety reasons and so on. So the solution to that problem is this this heat exchanger. It's a fabric heat exchanger, lots of little channels in there. It goes on top of my head, making me look sort of druid-like. And then these colder fittings right here plug in right there. And there's a little peristaltic pump that lets me pump ice water through the helmet liner. So it pulls about 70 watts out of my head. It's great. It's like when I was going across Iowa and in Wisconsin this summer, there were some days that were well into the 90s, and it just felt like walking into an air-conditioned room. It generated some interesting comments, though. I was going up this real steep hill in Wisconsin, and I had the landing gear down, and I was pedaling in something close to granny gear. And I was hot, so I was cranking the little pump back there. It's a manual peristaltic pump. There's this guy leaning on his fence out by the road, puffing on a pipe, watching me slowly go by. And as I passed, he says, "How much extra power you get out of that hand crank there?" It's one of my hobbies is collecting little comments like that. I like to start a tape recorder when I'm... Oh, I should say open paren, push, whatever. I was going to do all this with Peltier modules, and they're incredibly inefficient, but they are really neat, but nobody's come up with a thermal diode yet. And so by the time I had a good enough thermal path to pump heat out of the reservoir and out into the world, if I ever stopped pumping, meaning I needed the power for something else, the heat would just flow right back in again. So the solution now, the nice low-tech practical solution, is to stop at a 7-Eleven and buy a 99-cent bag of crushed ice, throw it in the tank there, and fill it with water. And that also lets me I have a sip tube with a bite valve here, so it's good for hydration. Anyway, when I'm off the bike, I like to keep a little, either run a little tape recorder or send a, or use the transmitter that picks up local audio and sends it to my pack. And here's some of the things that people say around the bike when I'm not there. It's great. One time in Texas, these guys were standing around, and there was about a 30-second silence, and then all of a sudden, one of them said, "Damn, that dude could survive a nuclear war." Obviously, he doesn't know about EMP. I'd be the first one disabled. Anyway, one of the nice things I can do with that, the security is a big issue on this thing, and I don't know how big an issue it really is, because people really don't mess with it very much, and stealing it is pretty unlikely. I mean, what would you do with it? but still, I'm paranoid. That the reality has nothing to do with my paranoia index. And so there's this fairly extensive security system, and one of the things that is a part of it is this loop, where if the bike is moved, it triggers a pocket beeper. It just pages me with this little paging antenna here. It's the same one that you use as one of the accessories in the Omnitracks. And when I'm beeped, in the old days, all it did was beep me, and then I had to drop my fork, go running outside into the parking lot to find out what's happening to the bike, and it's usually somebody going, "Oh, here's how he steers. Is this yours? Let me ask you some questions." And then that's it. My food gets cold. So now what I can do is send a touch-tone command from the little ham radio, little 2-meter HT, and open up an audio channel on a wireless intercom. It's a legal, a full duplex wireless intercom that lets me hear what's going on around the bike. And you can kind of judge if it's innocuous or not, so I just leave it alone if it is, unless the security alerts keep coming, meaning it's being touched and moved and all that stuff. To really have fun with this, I can take the little laptop computer or the little handheld note taker and send text to the bike through the packet link. There's this 4800 baud wireless link here. So it uses a Motorola RNET, little radio modems. And anything that I send to the bike can be piped to this text-to-speech board, the adapter. So the bike can talk, and they don't know there's a man behind the curtain, see? And so the bike can carry on a totally cogent and intelligent conversation with somebody. It's just especially good if I can peer out the window and see them. And so I can make comments about what they look like and things like that. And probably the most amusing single tale along those lines was up in Bainbridge Island, Washington. I was in a coffee shop with a friend of mine, and the bike was on the sidewalk, and this little 10-year-old kid or so came by, and he's got a skateboard, and he stopped, and he's kind of wide-eyed looking at the bike, and the bike said, "You have a strange bicycle there." And he said, "It's not a bicycle, it's a skateboard." And so the two of them started chatting. And, he's 10. He kind of grew up in the video and high-tech world, so it's not too weird, So this goes on for a while, and you know, they're trading stories and everything, and I'm cracking up in this restaurant, you know, talking to this kid. Well, he saw his mother come out of a shop a few doors down, and he said, "Wait right here." So he ran down the street, grabbed his mom, and dragged her back by the hand, and presented Mr. Bicycle, right? Well, she's like this, and of course the bicycle is totally silent. So naturally, she started giving him a lot of grief about lying and making up stories. And he's getting this kind of teary look on his face. He's really betrayed. And she says, "Come on, get home. I had enough of you." And she starts dragging him down the street. They get about four or five steps, and the bike says, "Hi there, pretty girl. Would you like to ride on me?" She froze in her tracks and turned to the kids going... So anyway, the street theater potential is limitless.
Did you save any of those?
I'm going to start doing that more and more because that's some of the best stuff. I wish I had that one on video. I'm starting to carry a video camera now, and you better believe I would have had that one if it was available. What's that? Candid camera. Yeah, I should do some subcontract work for it. You know, it's funny having the synthesizer as part of the security system. One of the things that it can do if this security system is triggered, which can happen any one of a number of ways, which I'll mention in a second. One of the old standard phrases, in the old days I just had stock phrases that were programmed into the VCP, and I wasn't interacting with it at all. I wasn't very smart. And there were about, I don't know, 32 or something standard phrases. And one of them was, whenever triggered by the security system, would say, "Do not touch or you'll be vaporized by a laser beam." And it's fascinating to see the different reactions that people have when the thing talks. Like around Silicon Valley, people go, "Hey, is that the SCO1 chip? Now listen." And they would touch it again and try to get it to talk some more. And get into this whole argument about different speech algorithms. And, you know, and in Alabama, I did this one time, and the same thing happened. And they all stepped back, "Whoa, dude." So it's the security system response has to be fine-tuned to the environment. Actually, there are six sensors for the thing. The first one, this piece of PVC here, this looks like a rather outlandish mounting for a light, and it is. Inside this piece of 4-inch gutter downspout adapter thing is a copper cone that I made that's just 90 degrees like this around. And you guys are microwave wizards, so maybe somebody can tell me if this is supposed to work, but it does. I got this off-the-shelf microwave motion sensor from Alpha Industries, and it's a 10 gigahertz feed horn with a gun diode, and I think it's supposed to be about 15 degrees or something divergence. And it just looks straight up, and I stuck the cone, the apex of the cone, right in the exit aperture of this feed horn. And the idea being that I still wanted the 15 degrees, but I wanted it spread all the way around in a circle. And it seems to work. The thing knows if anybody's within about 10 feet. And when I have it set, I've got it just adjusted just about right, so as I get close to it, it triggers. And but when I asked microwave people that I knew if I could do that, they go, "Aah." So microwaves are like that, I guess. But anyway, that's level one, and that's not necessarily a security alert, of course, because sometimes it's parked in front of a restaurant and you expect people around it. Level two is an ungo box, which is a 40 kilohertz field around a blob of mercury, and if the mercury moves, no matter what its initial position, the thing sees the motion, and it's wonderful, works well, so it sees this sort of stuff really easily. I think it's actually active at the moment. Yep, it's on. I don't normally keep the siren on, but when I have this parked in the mothership, which I've been using to do this trade show circuit, I use that inside the van because it's just such a brutal sound that nobody can stand it, you know, all inside metal walls. The reason the siren is here, by the way, it's right inside the rump here, aiming directly back at the curved front of the trailer. I chose that location because of the problem with dogs. And as it turns out, this 130 dB siren sweeping into the ultrasonic, bouncing off the front of the trailer, creates these two zones of terror right here. And you know, when a dog chases you, he wants to kind of close from the side and kind of come in like this, right? So as they get into this area, if I hit the siren, which I can override from a thumb button, then it's just... everything has to be multi-purpose, if at all possible. Anyway, that's level two. Level three, there are switches on every access panel, so either an optical interrupter or a micro switch, so anything that can be opened easily has a sensor on it, except for these packs. I haven't quite figured out how to do that yet. Level 4 sees wheel movement. There's an extra wheel sensor there. Level 5 will detect a body in the seat. That's not there yet, but I need a little switch in there because one of the cardinal sins when this is parked someplace is for someone to come sit on it to see what it feels like, and that does happen, amazingly. And level 6 is the GPS receiver. I've got the Trimble TANS here, and its latitude and longitude can be monitored as much as I want. And if those numbers start to change significantly without my being logged in, then the bike gets very upset about it. And it looks like at the highest level of security alert, there are 4 things that happen. It beeps me, of course, with the pager, but if I'm not close, that does no good. It can send out packets, a ham radio packet, which are basically just an alert message saying, help me, you know, I'm bicycle, et cetera, and giving that long. But no guarantee that hams are logged in or monitoring packet. Through the Omnitrax terminal, it can send, you know, basically yank the panic line or just format a message and send it to it. The easiest thing is to yank the panic line because the other processors may not be up. So here in the hub, there'll be somebody who says, oh, God, the bike's in trouble, and knows about where it is, and presumably will then act on that somehow, calling for an airstrike or something. And level 4, as long as I'm within one of those blobs that are pictured in the cellular roaming guides, it'll call 911 with the cellular phone and use the synthesizer, as was described before. I'm a bicycle, I'm being stolen. Help, here's where I am. Whereupon the dispatcher says, okay, kid, stop playing with the phone, or we're going to call your mom. By the way, speaking of cellular service areas, I started carrying another antenna. I'm not quite sure where to package it yet, so I didn't have it on the shakedown cruise. But this is good for, I don't know, like 30 miles or something, this old-fashioned analog cellular that I've got. there's a, Larson makes a cellular phone beam antenna, the YA5806, I think it is, and it's a six-element Yagi with about 10 or 11 dB gain. And I've tested it to about 130 miles. So I was in Anacortes, Washington one time and was able to make local calls in Seattle and Vancouver just by swinging the antenna around. Let me bring the beam around here just a second. So that helps a lot to make that service area clear. Let's see, I want to get into question and answer here. I'm trying to think if there's any other really major area that I've overlooked before I do. I'm sure there is, but I can't think of it. Any questions yet? Oh, yes, communications, thank you. I knew there was something. This is the BYP. Big yellow pole. And it goes, unfortunately the room won't permit this, but it goes up to about 12 feet roughly. And this is a dipole that I made out of a couple of all-band HF vertical antennas, the WIP antennas for mobile use made in Australia for hams. And it's 80 through 10 meters, I think 7 bands, yeah, 10, 12, 15, 17, 20, 40, and 80. And by doing this, I don't use the bike as half of the antenna system. Putting a traditional vertical on it and loading it the way people usually do in a mobile environment makes the other half of the antenna things like, you know, dynamic RAM boards and... and somehow it just didn't seem like a very good idea to me. So by doing this, I've got a true balanced antenna, and it seems to work pretty well in all bands, except I'm getting some trash back on 40 meters. I've got a computing SWR and power meter down there, and it shows negative SWR and power, and we know that's not possible. So I think what's happening is garbage coming back down the coax. So I got to get some ferrite beads and stick them up there as a choke, which I haven't done yet, but it's on the list. Anyway, this thing works beautifully. The other day at the Star of India, when I was waiting to do the media thing, I stuck it all the way up in the air and tuned around 10 meters, and immediately started chatting with a guy in his motorhome up in Mission, British Columbia, somewhere. Working into a long wire, so we chatted for a while, and then some guy in Montana. You know, it's really easy. I've worked Japan and Italy and all sorts of things while pedaling around. So, while pedaling, I don't have this fully extended in its horizontal mode because it's far too plain. It would just destroy itself. But when it's in its down position, I can also run it as a vertical dipole and bring the active element straight up and leave the counterpoise straight down. And that seems to work just fine. What drives that, which only about maybe 8% of you are going to be able to see. Well, I'll tell you about it. The back door of the trailer drops down here, and there's a complete communications bay. You can come up and look. I'll leave it open. You can look at it later. But what's back there is an HF ham radio, an ICOM 725, a 290 and 790 from Yaesu, which are 2 meter and 70 centimeter all band rigs, a small television station from AEA, so I can transmit video as a full motion video from a ham radio again. Antenna management and some audio filtering and a wonderful little thing called the Magic Notch, which I just love. Since I have so many computers on here, and you know how computers and radios are sort of mortal enemies? I generate a lot of birdies. There's trash all through the spectrum. This is not FCC Part 15 certified at all. Part 15, part whatever it is. The chief offenders are the 68 HC11 boards, and they're on two-layer boards that are not with no ground plane at all, really lousy grounding, and they generate a lot of garbage. And so when I'm operating an HF, if those things are on, I've got just, you know, every few hundred kilohertz, there's another whistle. And so the solution, and also the solution to people tuning up on frequency, which all hands know about, is this thing called the magic notch, and it's a switch capacitor audio filter that just sits there and scans the audio passband, and whenever it sees a continuous tone, it locks on, notches it out with about an 80 dB deep, 30 hertz wide notch. And it's wonderful. You can, in fact, I wonder, maybe there's some trash. Oh, here, we'll make some trash. You gotta hear this. This thing's cool. There's now trash. There's trash. Okay, the magic notch is founded. Now when I tell it to activate, tone goes away, but everything else is still there. So it's much nicer than using a standard filter where you try to roll something off and, you know, tweak lots of knobs to get that to happen. So anyway, I recommend it. And then, of course, you know what this is, so I don't have to talk about it at all. This is what I really wanted to mention here, is how this is integrated into the system. This is where it gets really fun. The communication link between the bike and the rest of the world is almost all RF, of course, because I really hate having to go on this endless quest for modular phone jacks, which is what characterized my first trip. And that can be amusing. You meet people in interesting ways that way. When you sort of introduce yourself as one seeking a modular phone jack. But so the reason this is on the bike is partly for security, but primarily for electronic mail. I kind of live in data space, and my connection with the world is through the modems and just all these network services. And lately, I've become really enamored of internet. So what we're working on now, with lots of help from John Ehrenberg here, is a integration of the Omnitrack system into a pipe between the bike and the internet that's seamless and transparent. And so what happens at the bike end, I'm going to do all this in present tense even though it's work in progress because it's easier. What happens at the bike end here is on the Macintosh we'll run Eudora, and Eudora will have an MCT tool or the COM toolbox has an MCT tool that makes Eudora think that that's its modem basically. So we select that as its device. And when I want to send a piece of mail, Eudora, of course, will just pipe it out through the COM toolbox into the MCT. And coding and compression and all that stuff to be determined. Whereupon the Omnitrax cues it and does its normal magic, and it appears here at the hub. And normally that would be sitting there waiting for someone to call the CI and log on and, you know, send it back to some dispatcher someplace. But at this end, Sun gave us another workstation, a 4260, which will sit here, and basically it's got two ports. One of them is talking to the CI all the time. And we'll grab that message, modify the headers as appropriate, and then hand it off to the internet. And all this will just happen transparently, same thing going on in reverse. And then we'll have at my home base, there's another workstation in which will be my actual normal mail address. So it's basically wordy at nomad.com. And its job is to filter things so that all my incoming email doesn't get passed through the satellite, because we have typically somewhere around 60 to 80 pieces of mail a day, and, you know, people might send me a 100K file or something, and I think that would be a little bit much, and I'd probably become kind of unwelcome on the bird here. so anyway, it will filter and basically only allow messages with certain originators and maybe a keyword in the subject line to actually get transmitted directly to the bike. But the really nice thing about that, obviously, is the same advantages enjoyed by all the truckers and other users of the system, is that wherever I am in North America or other places as time goes on, I'll be able to have fairly real-time communications with my home base and with those people who I want to be able to communicate with quickly. The other nice thing is having the panic line on that DB37 on the side of the MCT, of course, is really nice for security, because even without having everything up and smart, we can just yank that line and call for help. And that makes me feel a lot better than the cellular phone system, because the service is quite spotty in most of the places where I really like to be, which is away from cities. So anyway, let's go into Q&A mode again, which we started some time ago and somehow got away from. Yes?
What are you going to add?
Well, I don't know, but it's inevitable. Mobile television studio. Thank you. The evolution of this thing so far has become expressed as a sort of symbiosis, three-way symbiosis between the bike project, sponsors, and the media. and everybody wins. You know, sponsor gives me a neat new toy. I get all excited, and I'm happy because I get to play with a new toy. That makes the story for the media more interesting or new, so that somebody who covered me a couple years ago now wants to do it again. And, of course, that provides exposure for the technology, which in turn makes sponsors happy, so it just keeps on going in circles. The only downside is that I think I'm just about maxed out as far as how much stuff I can carry. And short of moving to a motorhome or a yacht, at which point I think it would lose some of its fundamental appeal. I think that's, at this point, what I'm going to try to do is take a different approach to maximizing my function weight ratio and try to get the weight to go back down.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about. How does the weight really break out, especially with battery?
Batteries are about 40 to 45 pounds total. The whole system is 580 when it's fully loaded for touring, which means big tent in here that accommodates the whole bike. It's huge. When this thing's on the road, actually the solar panels tend to become a little bit convex because, you know, you have to sit on the bike. It's a lot of stuff. I don't know how it really breaks down. I do have proof that that's the weight, though. I got a scale ticket from a co-op in Iowa that says 780 pounds. It's with me on it. Yeah? I have the basic equipment for doing it, but the antenna's the problem. The 2-meter and 440 rig from Yaesu, those multimodes, and the little ARR preamps are what I used for Oscar 13 with reasonable success, using a pair of cross Yagis from KLM. That was in a fixed location up in Silicon Valley, though. One day, just for the heck, only for the heck, it's completely impractical, I took the whole cross Yagi array with its crossboom and bolted it to this, and went pedaling down a long straight road in Milpitas while talking with a guy in Tasmania, a guy named Frank, on Oscar 13. And, you know, the conversation went on for a little while, and then finally, as always, he says, "So, what are your operating conditions there, old man?" And I said, "Well, I'm actually pedaling a bicycle at the moment. Why don't I describe it?" And he said something to the effect that only in America, you people are crazy. So that's, unfortunately, kind of impractical because I don't have the antenna gain. The other thing is I really like microsats, and I played with those just a little bit, again, with that antenna and active steering. I am told that if conditions are good, I haven't tried this yet, but I've got a Dick Jansen's antenna. It's a stack J-pole for 2 meters and 440. And I've heard that people are able to use that with some success, if not in a footprint where there's a lot of competition with people with big guns. So I don't know yet whether it's worth it for me to try to get that together for rural satellite operation.
Have you tried using the HF and the 2 meters to work RS-10?
No, I haven't yet, and I'd like to. That should be easy.
I mean, obviously the short path, the short passes like that aren't as good for your situation as Oscar 13, but mm-hmm. It's there and you've got the antenna for it.
Yeah, I just haven't done it yet, but I'd love to. Yeah, that's on the list.
How fast did you get this to go?
The maximum speed so far was with a gravity assist, and that was 50.5 along the Delaware River in New York. And it's an incredible adrenaline rush, too.
Yeah. The ABS system for the rear wheel?
Not yet. Normal cruising speed is about 9 miles an hour. That's gone down by 2 or 3 miles an hour since the old days when it weighed. What was your question?
Did you get speed wobbles?
No, it's real stable. It's amazing. I worked up to it pretty slowly. I've been in the 40s a lot, and then one day I was just feeling reckless and just decided to go for it, and just sort of opened it up. And that's with trailer and everything. It's amazing. So, I mean, that's the thing. Gravity has this really powerful effect no matter which way I'm going. You know? So, yeah.
What's your fully charged battery capacity? Do you have a problem with it?
It's 45 amp hours on the main bus, and it's sealed lead acid, so about the bottom 30% of that is useless. And I'm really hoping that somebody will come out with decent sized nickel hydride packs. At the moment, they're all just sub C and little stuff, and you know they make packs about this big. NiCads would be better from that standpoint, but they take a lot more active management to handle properly, and despite what the manufacturers tell you, and. I can't assume that the active control will always be there, although I've been looking into alternatives, because the NiCad is still about the same power to weight ratio. It's 0.78 pounds per amp hour versus 0.8, but at least you can use the whole thing. In fact, it's nice to. So I'm dragging my feet until nickel hydrides are available. But as far as the other half of your question, as far as running out, whenever I see it start to droop, I just make a point of finding power if I don't have the solar panels. It's good for... basically enough for an all-night ride with my lights. Oh, set a flag. I've got to tell you about lights. The Omnitrax draws about 3 amps. The Spark Station, I'm not sure yet. Those kinds of loads are basically intermittent duty anyway. I turn them on when I need them, and then they go away. There's another thing I want to say. One of the questions I keep getting at Sun, I have these sort of weekly open house series in the bike lab there, and a question I can almost count on every week is, why do you have all these other computers? and the answer is an important one, and that is that in a system like this, they're so used to thinking of things being plugged into networks all the time and plugged into AC all the time that power is just not really an issue. Because of the power requirements, yes, one Spark station could do everything, but they would have to be on continuously, even for stupid stuff like editing a text file or monitoring security or something, even though it could easily handle all my processing needs. So there's a lot of dynamic load shedding that goes on. I turn that on when I want to do image compression or mapping or the UUCP call-in via the cell phone. I have a cell blazer that's attached to the cellular phone. Also in the cellular phone, by the way, there's a cell jack, which gives me a modular phone jack. So there's a 12-volt answering machine, a little Panasonic with a cordless phone. So when I leave the bike, I just take the cordless, and if I'm far away, the answering machine takes the call. So I didn't mention, see, I keep getting vectored off into all these other things. There's, I mentioned also the lights. There are these, the only person who's going to see these really well is John here. There's a, he can attest to the fact that these are really bright. These taillights that I'm using are high brightness.